I'm ancient and I was still an adult in 2001. That's where I'm at. But so were you. So
yeah, no, I could drink on 9/11 and I did. Did I ever? Andy, you're a little bit younger, but not so much.
Yeah, I was freshman in high school when 9/11 happens.
Isn't it wild the way that the mass interpretation of it has changed, or at least it's like social media representation? Because I was on vacation, but I looked at X Twitter on September 11th, and there's always been conspiracies since the very beginning, and I've been fighting back against those for God 23 years at this point. But the anti-Semitism, I think this year and especially, was way worse than I'd seen it before.
No, it's always been. Though. It's always been pretty central.
Yeah, it's more. Maybe it's more explicit these days.
Yeah,
it's actually what you're seeing is Elon Musk doesn't just not suppress that speech. It seems to always make it into my For Your page.
Me too.
Which is kind of insane. I've been on other social media recently just to remind myself that Twitter's weird and it's full of Marxist-Leninists and Nazis. And I not to equate those two things, actually, but they're different. But they're both annoying. Depending on the kind of Marxist-Leninist, and one thing I've been talking about lately in this weird decay point, it's hard to know. When someone says they're a Marxist-Leninist, I no longer know what they believe at all. Like it's not a predictor of anything anymore. Other than that, like, they like pictures of Mustache Man, but that's really all I got. So it's, which in a way reflects, you know, me not knowing what social democracy or democratic socialism was in 2017, because it's like, oh, whatever the next trend is. But we're not here to talk about that exactly. I mean, we're talking about the renewal part. We're supposed to be hopeful. And I will say one of the interesting trends in Marxist-Leninist spaces on X is that all the multipolarity stuff and Marxist-Leninism, Duganism, and all that has become really unpopular with the birth of the ACP. Like, the ACP was apparently the line that made a lot of this stuff unpalatable to a whole lot of people who were soft on it priorly. So, you know, I get to watch Roderick Day and Gabriel Rockhill fight with former people of Midwestern Marx who they used to support just a few months ago. And that's, I don't know. I mean, it what's funny is, like, I'm rereading in the good translation versus the shitty bootleg translation that I got in 2018, Western Marxism by Domenico Lacerto, a book that I thought was like 50% good and 50% terrible.
You read it at the time?
Yeah, I read it as soon as I got in 2017, it was published in Italian. I think in 2018, there was a bootleg translation flying around the internet, and I kind of went through it. Carlos Garrido's book on Western Marxism is kind of a crib notes of it with a few minor differences. And the stuff on early liberalism in that book is actually pretty good in the Western Marxism book. But the scholarship on Western Marxists are like arbitrary and picked to just make a point. And often he's citing, like, for example, in Ernst Bloch, he's citing all the stuff he cites by Ernst Bloch is before Ernst Bloch was a Marxist, almost all of it. So it's just, it's a really strange reading of history that posits this counter narrative that also vastly simplifies the debates in Italy and in China. But American readers of this book do not have that context. They do not know what the stakes are. They don't really know the arguments about Togliatti and Eurocommunism. They don't really understand Maoism's divisions internally to China, not just, you know, what they hear about it here in the quote West. And so the book kind of gives them a reorientation myth that, if you read it closely, is also very clear. abandons the Marxist critique of the withering away of the state entirely. Mm-hmm. In fact, he actually picks up Hegel's philosophy of right to justify just never going there. We don't need to do that. The state's always needed as a form of civil mediation. And that's implied in the book. And that's never pointed out how even from a Marxist-Leninist perspective, that's right deviationism. Mm. And it's in Lacerda. So the fact that people are seeing all this stuff emerge in just generic communism right now, and it's going all kinds of weird nationalistic directions. I mean, people are trying to talk about we need national renewal projects along the lines of China to develop the productive forces in the United States.
Yeah.
And the core of the bourgeois world. Like,
very bizarre to try to import
it's a weird import. It's a weird decontextualized importation, even from the Marxist-Leninist standpoint. Like, it's not my point. Like, I'm not a Marxist-Leninist, but I'm not here to shit on that tradition. This is a weird misunderstanding of even that tradition.
Or at least a reinterpretation, an attempt to try to steer that tradition in a direction where, yeah, a national renewal project, like a Dungas project, is on the table in the United States, which I think is really the inspiration for all of this. It's the seeing the quote unquote successes of what's happened in China over the last 30 years in terms of development. I had a run in with Carlos Garrido from Midwestern Marx. He and I got along just fine on the Platt panel that I was on in Chicago in the springtime. And the most that I got from his critique of Western Marxism and his presentation was not about that, but of course it did come up in the question and answer. And it was essentially a conspiratorial argument that, you know, the OSS and then later on the CIA funded Western Marxist as a way, Western Marxism and critical theory as a way to confuse and disorient the Western working classes, and that the left, such as it exists now in the United States, is a controlled op. It's like the acceptable left. It's the gatekeeping left, whereas there's some sort of pure Marxism, Leninism, Neo-Stalinism that has been brushed aside and that we need to reconnect with. All that said, we have on the panel today, and three people I think constitutes a panel maybe, somebody who just last week was on another Platypus panel with a real member of the American Communist Party in the flesh. You say, oh, it's an online phenomenon. These people don't exist in real life. Well, Andy sat down with one of them or two of them and discussed things. So Andy, you want to report back from that panel? Tell us what the stakes were.
Nikki the Hegelian was right. He was a beautiful man. He he carried himself well. He talked extemporaneously and with confidence, so he did a great job. His name's Grayson from the American Communist Party. So it was him and somebody from the RCA, the former IMT, and then there was a new left professor who is now basically defending the Democratic Party and liberalism. And so it sort of turned into me and that professor joining forces as like the new left and then the new left, because I was doing this kind of parody of myself where I was reading Jerry Rubin quotes and situationist quotes and sort of updating them to the present day. And I was hoping it would be funny, but maybe my delivery wasn't making that clear enough. So I think people just thought I was a lunatic.
Did you have Antifada people in the audience?
No, I didn't recognize anyone in the audience except for the Platypus people I know and I tend to like. But there's a few like students who are just curious. There's about 20 people there. And yeah, I have to work on my delivery a bit for these things because people did not find it as funny as I did. I had a great time. It was hilarious.
I love your delivery and I find you to be very funny.
Thank you.
So I guess they lost something in translation. I don't know.
But yeah, the debate sort of turned, it was supposed to be on democracy, but just as the nature of who the panelists were, the debate sort of came between the Trotskyists and the ACP brand of Stalinism defending the party form and basically saying like, when you come out of this panel, I want you to join our party. And then the new left guy being like, just, you know, sort of interrupting them at the end and being like, but what are you going to do in November? Who are you going to vote for? We have to stop fascism. And then I sort of tried to turn the whole thing into a parody and called for people to take like real action in their own lives and recognizing that the party form is not really going anywhere and has been a failure for the last century or so. So that was basically the debate, and yeah, it was fun. It's on YouTube. Nice. You can link it in the show notes.
Yeah, will do. What's your take on all that, Varn?
I find the ACP very interesting. I am on record as disagreeing with Walsh Rolf about whether or not I actually consider the ACP a valid representation of Stalinism, which people have often taken me as defending Stalinism, but I don't actually think there are Stalinist elements to it. But having read all the different groups, I think Garrido is a Marxist-Leninist. Truly, I mean, I've gone through his stuff. I've read a lot of his stuff. I would consider him a slightly right deviationist Marxist-Leninist, but he's within the bounds of that historical school of thought. I think Haas is not at all. The appeals to Stalin and Deng are a national developmentalist, but having gone through the rise of MAGA communism and a few other writings of his, he references conservative revolutionaries and para-fascist way more than any other Marxist. And the Marx that I do see there isn't Stalin, it's Stalinized Bordiga, which would make Bordiga roll over in his grave, but it is kind of the influence. I also see a lot of influences of the Cybernetic Research Unit and Reza Nagastani and Nick Land. Yeah. Recently in their circles and ACP circles, there's been debates between them about how to be anti-immigrant. There's been pushback between them on on some of them picking up the recent conspiracy theories against Haitians, and has, to his credit, which is, I don't give him a lot of credit for anything, but to his credit, while he took a stance that is ahistorical to communist stance, but historical to what communist parties actually did. He's right about that. But it's not what Lenin or even Stalin said they should do.
There was an interesting appeal. I saw some of the back and forth on that on social media, and it was interesting that the appeal was solely towards actually existing socialism in practice. So right. There is like... outside of the theoretical stuff, outside of the Heideggerian, outside of the national conservatism and the Stalinized Bordigism, which I think you should maybe unpack that a little bit for the audience and us, because I think that's a fascinating synthesis. I think that there's something practical about this, right? Like Haas understanding the ACP project as like a practical party building thing, and looking at the history of the 20th century, trying to come up with some sort of package of policies and programs necessary in order to like actually take power, right, someday, which is an interesting turn. I think we've all talked about this before, what that turn towards the party means. I wonder if this is a renewal, but maybe a dark renewal.
You know, I think it's a parody. To be frank, okay. I think it's a parody. We have no idea how many people are in the ACP. We have no idea. The only Marxist organization that I can give you hard numbers on in the United States is the DSA. And calling that organization Marxist is a little bit of a stretch, depending on which caucus and chapter you're talking about.
Farn, can I ask you something?
Yeah.
So what Grayson was really stressing at the debate is the ACP's position, I think, accepting the sort of Bolshevik or Comintern definition of fascism as like the power of finance capitalism, like the unabridged power of finance capitalism or something, the sort of pre-Popular Front definition, I think. And using...
Yeah, it's the third period position.
Okay.
Go ahead.
And then using that to say the Democrats are the party of finance capital, Kamala is the candidate of finance capital, and Trump represents something a bit outside of that, although not endorsing MAGA or Republicans. He was clear about that, but he did have this, he did really stress that, I think he even used the term like cabal of bankers to talk about where he was coming from in terms of needing to defeat the Democratic Party.
Third period's understandings of fascism are interesting, and also overlined with Bordiga. So I can actually do two things. I can respond to that and talk about Stalinized Bordigism. There's a rumor that Haas was this poster in Red Left called Rafik, who was a Bordigas. Their writing style, I've looked at it, is remarkably similar. I'm not going to invest a lot of time train spotting that or trying to prove it one way or the other. But so what
this Rafik character also spoke like a Bond villain.
Yes. also, obsessions with stuff like the Mongol Horde, that kind of stuff showed up in both. But he was a pretty robot Bordigas. And what you see in the ACP via Haas versus via Midwestern Marx, and I don't know how they reconcile this. Midwestern Marx is Dingus Popular Frontism, Tote Court. That's what it is. That's what it was anyway before it joined up with the ACP and the MAGA communist synthesis under Hinkle and a few dissident members of the IWW and a few other people that we can actually identify in that organization. The things about it that are interesting is you saw a turn with Marxist-Leninist focusing on finance capital, which is not a historical Marxist-Leninist focus. It's actually, frankly, a historical fascist focus. The fascists themselves, the biggest critique of capitalism was finance capital versus the petty entrepreneur. You see that in the work of Werner Sombart, that before he was a Nazi and then when he became a Nazi. And if you have anything like a theoretical apparatus for German Nazism, we have a lot better theoretical apparatuses for Italian fascism.
Because of Gentile and others, yeah.
Yeah, Gentile and the National Singleists, the Cirque Proudhon, you know, we can talk about that. But what we see in German fascist thought was the idea that finance capital was a feather on the entrepreneur. And that was the side that won out with Hitler versus the Strasserite interpretation, which was closer to National Bolshevism. And sort of Prussian socialism a la Oswald Spengler. So I find it interesting, but that's been a long trend and not just in these ACP types. If you look at the work of Michael Hudson, who's a proto MMTer who's been associated with MMT, he's been also talking about, you know, finance capitalism, productive capitalism, and socialism as if finance capitalism is only a fetter on production. Any sound study of the historical view of finance capital will point out it is a fetter of production post 1970. There's a truth to that. It is not prior to that, and it's very much part of how capital is able to space things out over time.
Yes.
The focus on finance capital, I think structural anti-Semitism is an overused multi-postone trope. But I do want to say there's a reason why Duganist and people who come out of like the founder of American Front went and endorsed the ACP. It's now called New Resistance. New Resistance is a Duganist organization. American Front was an explicitly third positionist Nazi National Bolshevik organization in the 1990s. This founder, James P., is in Russia now. He left the United States, I think about a half decade ago. And he came out on X and endorsed the ACP.
Has ACP responded to that at all?
They accepted the endorsement.
Wow.
They just didn't talk about his past at all.
Wow.
Like, they don't go into... They're not like, they'll take Duganist endorsements, but they don't go into what these people's politics were before, say, 2018, 2019, or in James P's case, 2012. Because James P was one of the people who got on the Dugan train, and actually, I know this because he tried to infiltrate a group I was actually in on Facebook, weirdly, to spread Duganist versions of anti-imperialism amongst leftists in 2012, 2013. And so the it's thin. Now, I actually don't think we can call the ACP a fascist organization. I think that's vulgar. And I don't think we can speak to everyone who's in it or even all the leaders. Like I said, there's a big difference between Haas, and I'll get back to the border guy Stalinism again, and Midwestern Marx, which is just kind of dingism with some like, oh, but we're not throwing Vietnam out, but we're not going to mention the Sino-Soviet split, really. We're going to kind of pick on Khrushchev, but we're not going to talk about like the Cambodian Vietnam War or China siding with the U.S. yeah. or any of that.
But still make anti-imperialism a central part of the agenda.
Right.
A vulgarized anti-imperialism.
Whereas the Haas form of this sees the left as the manifestation of capital and the right as a botch politics that can't happen. That's what he says explicitly in The Birth of MAGA Communism. He also uses phraseology about the left of capital that does not have a history in Marxist-Leninism. Its history is in ultra-leftism and in left communism.
The left wing.
And he also talks about organic compositions and organic, like, you know, organic development in a way that the only Marxist I know that does that is Bordiga. That's the thing that makes Bordigism different than left oppositionism is the focus on organic centralism and the focus on the left wing of capital. And by that, we mean the Popular Front, mm-hmm. which makes the ACP's politics, other than their focus on finance capital, which they would both agree on, really vague. It seems like it's a multiple interpretations of historical Marxist-Leninism that are not actually copacetic, but in so much that they want to own the libs, and that's their primary goal, and that they'll take almost any endorsement from any group to do that, even like pretending that James P. of New Resistance / American Front somehow represents an organic proletarian mindset in the United States is insane. But
are they concerned with organic proletarian mindset? I think the MAGA communism MAGA communism, as I understand it, was nodding towards that, right? Because it understands Make America Great Again and like the groundswell of support, some of it working class towards Trump, as reflecting like a militancy within the proletariat that could then be used and harnessed in order to turn them towards the MAGA communist project.
These are also people who argued with me that Engels' endorsement of communism in 1844, by that I mean Fortierist and Owenite communism in the United States and communes, was proof that the United States was already a communist country in 1844. I mean, so these people use texts, they read these texts, they find them, they totally decontextualize them, and then will make wild claims. And I actually do think that's part of their appeal, and it's also part of their sorting mechanism. I used to accuse the IMT / RCP Part 85 of the same thing, because one of the things, if you know, when you go into the International Marxist Tendency, is they make you really focus on the critique of the Big Bang first.
Yeah, I brought this up. I brought this up at the panel. This is my critique of the RCA. I said, look, this seems like a great organization, but I just read through your newspaper and I've seen some photos of you guys marching and there's nothing about the Big Bang. This is the most important contribution of Alan Woods. And I was definitely trolling, and I think the Platypus people knew that, but the RCA guy, I don't think he got it. And he seemed to seriously consider my suggestion. He was like, I don't know if that debate's really going to help us. But back to the ACP, I remember the Haas type people had a phase online where they were defending the petty bourgeois as like
around the trucker convoy. Yeah.
Not just that, but even before that, just the, you know, about like crime and shoplifting and that sort of thing. And I wonder if that is, I think that's kind of essential if you're going to defend MAGA as a real threat. Because I understand MAGA as having a petty bourgeois vanguard that has a worldview of, you know, small capitalism unencumbered by finance capital, right? Like the sort of the Steve Bannon's version of Leninism. And this kind of makes them incompatible at all with Marxism, the insistence that the working class stands alone outside the petty bourgeoisie and other class fractions is, I think, pretty essential to any definition of the proletariat or working class revolution. I'm just not sure if they still use that terminology anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting. Right. Yeah, I feel like there's something interesting at work here, right? And it's a question of class, and it's a question of definition. It's a question of sociology, but then it's also a question of politics too, right? there's, as we know in the United States, like a huge amount of slippage between working class and middle class. I feel like a dedicated organization which seeks to find organic intellectuals and rank and file within the working class to make those people the center of a politics and build a politics around that thing. Obviously posits, as Andy said, to find a proletarian core, right? The problem is, and I think that what these people, to give that to steel man their argument or to give them the benefit of the doubt, I feel like it's a reaction to the decadence of the left and especially the new left, which sought to see the lumpen elements as like the vanguard of a revolution. I think what they do is they see this tendency on the left, and then they try to bend that stick, and they bend it the wrong way until they're actually, the core of what they see is not a working class that like is skilled or semi-skilled and organized within production and actually capable of social organization and social coordination because of their particular place, you know, within the class system. And I'm talking about organized workers generally here, because they have this kind of distorted understanding, or they have this reaction to the new left and to the Popular Front and to the quote unquote libtards or whatever, and people in the DSA, they then start to look around for a social actor that represents what an organized working class should look like, which is a capable of coordinated action, capable of political expression. But the only place you find that in this country, and you find it, as Andy said, in MAGA communism, is the organized petty bourgeoisie. And so in their attempt to try to get past, I think, a real impasse and a real block with like who we're trying to organize under what conditions and how are those people going to relate to an important other part of the working class, which is the lumpen, right? These two sectors need to be aligned with each other. They end up making a fetish character of the petty bourgeoisie and displacing the working class from that in their attempt to try to have a more populist politics.
So I think that's fair. I would go on and talk about maybe one of the this is a problem in Marxism, deeper than the ACP. In fact, maybe the ACP is a superficial way to get to it. There is a long tradition from the Second International National Forward to see the consolidation of capitalist monopolies in joint stocks and state alignment with the state as a positive tendency. That's Hilferding. Lenin actually critiques that. His view of imperialism borrows from Hobson and Bukharin, and it's based off two competing contradictory tendencies: the tendency of organic composition leading to monopoly, and the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. Those two tendencies he sees as mediated by the states, which put states in direct competition with one another in a way where they have to directly fight to expand both their organic composition and offset their tendency of the rate of profits to fall, both in expanding into the quote periphery, not a term used at the time, a term we'd use now, mm-hmm. and in competing with each other for direct territory. All right, that's the Lenin critique and up to World War One. The issue that we have is that is true for that time period. Absolutely. After World War II, though, that is not true. We do not see capitalist states in direct competition for that kind of organic composition for two reasons. One, the nuclear bomb fundamentally changes calculus. And two, you start seeing currency developments to offset the decline of real commodity values. Mm. And this is something that like Grossman and them did not deal with. And it was definitely something ignored by Hilferding. So on one hand, there's going to be a tendency to raise the power of the proletariat by breaking up the intermeshment of big monopolies in the state. And this you'll see in the most extreme form in the ACP. You'll see it in a lesser form in Platypus Affiliated Society and what's going on for a project for a new socialist party with Platypus. You will also see, however, and you see this in Jacobin and some other people, a tendency to push big capital, which is bad for the workers as consumers, but big capital is actually fine with relative regulations because it really can't absorb the cost. Mm-hmm. And it has direct ties with the state. And in some ways, some of the big capitalists, both in production and in tech, are basically parastates themselves with more power than any given state.
Certainly the auto industry and the aerospace industry in the United States is.
Yeah, well, I don't know. The auto industry was. The aerospace industry is. But
I don't know. I think about the massive amount of state investment and state subsidy and regulation around the transition to electric vehicles. And obviously the great importance that the state played in the labor disputes we saw over the last
But a General Motors CEO nor Sean Fain going to be able to tell the government what to do, whereas actually some of these tech giants can. They can say no. Or they can at least contest. There's pushback on that now. I mean, the Google anti-monopoly stuff is part of it. But this means Marxist and even some non-Marxist socialists are in really weird coalitions on how to deal with big capital. And the people who push against it push on the petite bourgeoisie, but they don't push on the petite bourgeoisie as proletarianizing into the proletariat. They produce on the petite bourgeoisie as a separate class with its own interests, which should be incorporated into a socialist mission. They go to developing nations and Marxist-Leninist theory about developing nations, a la Mao, to do that. That's why there's four stars on the flag. The petite bourgeoisie is one of them.
Block of four classes,
right, as opposed to the internationalist large comprador bourgeoisie. But again, that is weird from the focus in Marx. Now, in Marx and Engels, there's discussion, there's real discussion about like the joint stock company as a precursor to socialism because it socializes labor and leads to collective control and structuralizes capital. All right, and if you could seize that by whatever means, then you would actually have one of the technologies to socialize capitalist production because joint stock companies actually do planning. All right.
Yeah.
And
this goes as far back as Capital Volume 3, right?
Right. It's in Capital Volume 3. It's in Socialism, Utopian, and Scientific. And so to be fair to our ACP semi-comrades, I'm going to be charitable and think some of them might be, that they are picking up on something real. Now, okay, their claim about the ideology of fascism, they are correct that the 7th Congress of the Comintern endorsed a speech by Dimitrov that said that fascism was finance capital. All right. There was still stuff being published on that as late as 1936. What happens in 1936, though, is beginning of the French Popular Front, which then spreads to Italy, which is endorsed by the Comintern formally the next year. Mm-hmm. So you have an issue here. The other thing is the empirical studies on fascism, frankly, actually confirm both the Bukharinist and the Trotskyist, who were opposed to each other, but they both actually agreed on this, that the class base of fascists wasn't just finance capital. Finance capital was involved, but finance capital was involved because finance capital was a tendency that could both help or hurt the petite bourgeoisie and lumpenized classes. So the view of the left opposition and the ultra left and the right deviationist, believe it or not, was that fascism was a project of the petite bourgeoisie and other decomposing classes supported by finance capital as a way to restart profitability and state cohesion and to further integrate the state in with capital. I will say in the Italian case, that's actually a little hard to argue if you get into like the real history of it, but it's true that their base was largely petite bourgeois. Their thought leaders came from three places: the social democratic movement, elements of the conservative modernizing movement around Marat that picked up in the Italian elite school, and then a shit ton of people from the national syndicalist and the maximalist faction of the Italian Socialist Party. So to say that it's just finance capital has always seemed to me to be a cop-out by the Comintern to not deal with the fact that the Comintern actually laid some of the grounds for this. And this is actually, it's important that we're talking about 1936. We're talking about financing as the, you know, the most militant, chauvinistic, and imperialist part of finance capital. But we have to remember what else happens in 1936, in addition to the popular fronts.
I don't know, the second New Deal.
The lead up to the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I think one of the things, if it's just finance capital, like the Borgias say, we don't have to fight fascism specifically because it's a form of capitalism. And so fascism should just be fought like we fight any form of capitalism. That was their argument. Thus the Popular Front and the United Front were from above. Borga actually did formally endorse the United Front from below, but were acceptable. Ironically, Borga's position is the position of the Comintern when Borga's kicked out. Like the abandonment of Popular Fronts from above and the abandonment of the United Fronts from above and the abandonment of the Popular Front is adopted from 1927 to about 1936. But he's still kicked out of the party because he opposes the Bolshevization, even though he considers himself the uber-Leninist and more Lenin than, like, the Russians, actually. Yeah. That's his argument. that he opposes the Bolshevization of the party because he doesn't think that the special considerations for Russia make sense in Italy. And he just thinks that, what are you talking about, an Italian and French wrote the socialism in the Capitol Square? It doesn't make any sense. That's Borga's composition. But I would say there's a tension in Marx that is unresolved in Marx about whether or not we think monopoly capital is good for socialism because it consolidates things and we can seize it and it's already centralized, or bad because it further ties capital to the state, consolidates the state with capital in a very real way, and makes the state and capital collaborate with the suppression of the workers and with forcing class collaborationism. And the other thing is, both fascist and some forms of developmentalist Marxist-Leninist, for very different reasons, are both class collaborationists. They are. Explicitly, particularly when you get into the Popular Front period. So
what I find interesting is that this argument, this debate, this unresolved issue that ACP is touching upon and we're talking about right now, has a different valence when you're part of, like, the organized labor left, as I've been for a long time, because the arguments that I would make, and I'd throw them out not in, like, programmatic ways, but as something to talk about, as I often do, is that obviously it's easier to organize if you're fighting for trade unionism, either militant or business trade unionism, against a large corporation as opposed to a series of smaller ones. And that's maybe the way that I would have gone about looking at this issue before. And I'm not saying this simply to, like, swing dicks or, like, cast aspersions or whatever, but I find it telling that none of these groups seem to have attempted to, or certainly haven't made any headway in attaching or trying to make connections with actually existing labor organizations in the United States. Because there is a way in which I've always found that helps to keep us grounded. You know, Varun, obviously you're a union member. I'm a union member as well. And Andy has a really cool concrete laborer's jacket that I got him one time for a present. But I find it interesting in this sort of pseudo renewal that we see right here, that trade unions and actually existing working class organizations don't come up, because there is a different way to get at this question if you're just looking at practical, like, nuts and bolts trade union consciousness stuff.
I would also, I mean, I think that's actually pretty interesting. One of the reasons why I can't tell how big any of these organizations are, in addition to the fact that they don't make their numbers public, and the ACP is too new for us to even expect them to, frankly. But
yeah,
I might be even go so far as to say I'd be surprised if they know how many people they actually have. But
they don't have dues. I saw they have they encourage entrepreneurialism among their chapters, which is interesting too. I don't know if you saw that little
kerfuffle. Which feels like what Marxist group would ever encourage entrepreneurialism? This has actually been a critique I've had of the party press forum and all this, and Trotskyist stuff. I mean, Trotskyist dominated the interpretation of American Marxism for a long time because they were both more tolerated in the academy than Marxist-Leninists, who mostly kept their Marxist-Leninists somewhat on the DL. I mean, there were plenty of Marxist-Leninists in the American Academy even after the Red Scare, but they kept it on the down low. So Trotskyism represented the American left intellectual tradition for a shit long time. In the 1980s, as I've discussed in one of my episodes on my show, this shift to the British Trotskyists in specific representing that tradition, even in America, and we see this in the RCA, because that is a tendency, one of the many tendencies of orthotrotism, led by Ted Grant. Yeah. And then we saw the decline of Cliffite Trotskyism with the fall of the ISO, partly because of business transparency practice forced on it by its publishing house, which was a multi-million dollar affair on the Haymarket Books, which actually forced the ISO to deal with some of its internal bullshit that it had been suppressing for years, which dissolved the organization the moment it really came to light. That almost happened to the SWP, which is kind of the mother organization of the ISO in the early aught-teens too, if you remember the scandals around Alice Kalinikos's party.
Yeah.
But what I find interesting, because I've been working on an essay about this, and I want to get Andy's take on this too. And this is not, you know, I'm talking about all these theoretically really adroit nitty-gritty detail shit that we're getting into here. But like, we have to ask ourselves a question: when have we seen this before? And the answer is actually kind of interesting, because we talk about the New Left, and Annie was talking about the New Left. Well, what was the immediate successor group to the New Left? Well, when the SDS dissolved, you saw the beginnings of the New Communist Movement. And when the New Communist Movement failed to materialize, although it did lead to the CPUSA jumping from 5,000 back to about 10,000 members, but then immediately losing it. And the birth of like 1,000 Maoist sects, right? But what happened is it went into third worldism. Jay Sakai is from that period, but there's just a plethora of third worldism, which gets theoretically worked out actually in the West in 1982, 83, 84, in this Maoist third worldist and Maoist internationalist, Marxist internationalist Maoism movements and stuff like that. And we kind of went through all that at one time, like very quickly from the burn of diaspora. We saw Jay Sakai come back out of like a ghost. You guys dealt with that. Mm-hmm. But by the time you guys finished your reading of Jay Sakai Suttler's book, it was already out of vogue again.
Yeah, it feels that way. Yeah.
Like, and what you saw was this return to like William Z. Foster, pink colored glasses. Americanism, and also people trying to claim people like Gerald Horn and Jay Sakai weren't Marxist-Leninists. Like that, Garrido actually claims that in footnotes in his book on Western Marxism, which is just false. Like they were. The idea that Garrido says that that Jay Sakai was probably an anarchist paid by the State Department or the CIA or something in his footnote of that book, and I'm like, there's absolutely no evidence for that. It's just asserted.
It fits in with the paranoid style, though, of that policy.
Right. So, I mean, I'm not going to say there's nothing that they pick up from the tradition of Marxist-Leninism that's legitimate. I just mentioned that their reading of Finance Capital is based in Dimitrov's statement, which was endorsed by the 7th Congress of the Comintern. But it's a weird melange of, like, I like this thing from this year and this thing from this year and this thing from this year. And I'm not going to try to figure out what their actual context is, so I can make very wild claims on the internet. And the other thing I'm going to say, Sean, is we should be very careful about basing our views, even of social media, off of X, because I don't see this shit on other social media. I see Marxist-Leninists on other social media, but I might see ACP stuff a little bit. I saw Midwestern Mark stuff on other social media.
Yeah.
But like the rabid anti-Semitism and all that, that's because X is basically Truth Mobile now. I mean, like,
yeah,
we communist on it because also we like fighting and we like relatively unregulated speech zones, which Facebook, you know, as we can all tell,
and Twitter used to be a place where you could like kind of poke in and take the temperature and see what people were talking about, see what debates there are on the left. And you can still see that a little bit on X to the extent that like the left is still on there. But you're right, it's overwhelmingly right now a car wreck. You know, I sign on now to see which terrible things, which body horror and snuff films are recent these days. And there's definitely diminishing returns. Andy, I think
people are calling everybody secret Jews too. I mean, as a not so secret half Jew, it's kind of amazing. Go ahead, Andy.
Oh, I didn't know you're a part of the tribe. Mazel tov. yeah, I think your the lineage you put out is, you know, it's true of some of the new left go to the new communist movement and then end up in Sakai or neo-Stalinism, or like you can see an intellectual tendency in that way. But of course, a lot of the new left also goes to the NGOs or just leaves the movement altogether. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of ways people end up. And I think why we're seeing this rebirth of Stalinism right now is because all of these sects have been for so long unrelated to the working class that they're sort of like stuck at this blueprint stage of like, how do we build the apparatus to lead the working class? Because nobody's leading them right now except for the Democratic Party or these, you know, adventurous ultra-leftists like me or the unions, and so we have to build something new, and we have to get all the left militants into this party. And how do we do that? Well, we argue over like the significance of the sickle and hammer. So, like the RCA and ACP both use a sickle and hammer. I don't think it's any coincidence that the IMT rebranded themselves as the Revolutionary Communists with a sickle and hammer as a way to push back against Stalinism claiming that symbol. But yeah, it's still my impression of that panel was like, this is all very irrelevant discussion to anybody's life. And the only people who would be interested in it are the people who are interested in train watching and debating about the left and debating about 1917. And I think it's, yeah, it's all kind of a waste of time.
Well, this actually gives me the being able to cover something I wanted to cover before you guys came on, which is, you're absolutely right, Andy, that actually most of the new left did not go into the new communist movement, even though the new communist movement was quite large. Most of the new left did exactly what Christopher Lash said it was going to do, go into NGOs, self-improvement schemes, went into the broader like self-obsession slash decadence of the 70s. That's what happened to most of it. Even some of the militants went that way. What I think we're seeing in real time, and I quietly refer to this to a friend of mine. I'll mention him a name, Sam Kangaroo. We refer to this as the burning diaspora. Mm-hmm. Is the burning diaspora is going through this in rapid succession. So what happened over the course of like 20 years after the new left, we've actually seen happen in about four, tied to election cycles in a weird way, which actually does illustrate that this is more about people who view politics as a form of identity and as a form of media consumption, than as real, you know, movements integrated with the working class, because it's responding to the media election cycle and to Twitter. Now, I'm not going to say that there aren't people in the working class who do that, but every Pew poll I've ever said, and also just anecdotes because I know working class people, even by the blue collar definition, come from that background myself. They don't give a shit about politics the way a lot of people do, who are quote PMC or whatever. And they also don't talk about the PMC. Mm-hmm. They might talk about educated, but like it's actually an interesting betrayal that you are from that sector of society when you critique it in that way, because you kind of have to know the vice signaling against the virtue signaling of certain professional and managerial types to counter signal in that way. And you have to follow politics in a way that is kind of a white collar thing. And I'm using white collar and blue collar and not working class and bourgeois, because I think it's actually more accurate to the sociological thing that we're talking about here, because some of the white collar is proletarian and some of the blue collar is petit bourgeois. Yeah. So it's something that we have to like be very cautious with. But I think if you want to see this, I think the ACP is an interesting development in that it's both, it has elements of ultra leftism, but like in the way that negationism has elements of ultra leftism in it. Like it's,
yeah,
it's
check out the Antifa to Christmas episode for negationism.
But it also has elements of Marxist Leninism in it. I don't think it's really, it can't really claim as much as it wants to historical continuity. But some of the interesting things that they do, and I don't even think they mean to do this, but you'll see Marxist-Leninists who oppose the ACP, like cite Lenin, and then the ACP say, well, this is what the communist states actually did, and this is why we endorse it. And sometimes they're right. Like, if you look at what the Congress is, or what Lenin or even Stalin said they were going to do, and then what they actually did, sometimes the ACP is actually accurately reflecting what they actually did. And there's no like thinking about the fact that there's a discongruity between what these parties said they were gonna do
and what they're capable of doing.
And why they did it. There's no capacity of reflecting on capitalism. And this is one of the things I want to talk about a little bit. I recently read a Jasper Burns takedown of Vincent Bevins's book, If We Burn. And I often give Jasper a hard time. I don't know him personally. I just argued with him on Facebook 10 years ago. But
I give him a hard time as someone who knows him personally.
Very nice guy. Very good dude.
Jasper's right that there's no, in Vincent Bevins's book, there's no question of how the verticalist ideologies of Marxist-Leninism got stalled out in the 70s. He acts like if the new left was predominantly anarchist, which it absolutely was not. Mm-mm. Right. And so it leads to a question about like, well, why did these things happen? Maybe it's not all ideological genealogy, but if you talk to the ACP, it is, and it's a conspiracy theory by the CIA to suppress, you know, to maintain American hegemony with these other ideas, not people coming up and facing material reality. And I say that in terms of like, reason I mentioned Ernst Bloch and Lacerda way back in the beginning of this conversation is Ernst Bloch is like Grossman and like Brecht. Bloch chose to live in East Germany. He chose to live in the DDR. It's hard for me to say a person is anti-Soviet when in 1946, they choose to live in East Germany by choice. Hardly something you'd expect from a CIA op. Also, the CIA, even in its OSS and State Department forms, wasn't around early enough to corrupt some of these groups. It just, like, they're not active until the 30s, even the OSS. So it's kind of an ahistorical view of history. There is, you can really throw shit at the Frankfurt School. They had ties to the USS. You can throw shit about all the Trotskyists and Frankfurt Schoolers who worked with the Congress for Cultural Freedom that was sponsored by the CIA. They didn't know it. It's like getting mad at anyone who's ever taken CIA money because they took a grant at a university. Every single fucking person who works in sociology, economics, international affairs has probably got some kind of intelligence funding without even realizing it. But there is a real critique there. But on the larger tradition that they try to construct, it's very weird. And it's even weirder because in Lacerda, it's clear that Lacerda is at least more honest than some of these other people and says, well, you know, Mao had to have a brief moment of Western Marxism too. And I'm like, how the fuck do you explain that? Like
what I picking up on some of the things you're saying, if we're trying to isolate what's neo-Stalinist about this, and I think the conspiratorial aspects, especially around Western Marxist and figures of derision within these neo-Stalinist groups, there's the type of paranoia that really expresses itself in a violent way to the deaths of tens of thousands of good communists in the 1930s with the Great Purges. So for ACP, the undermining of the communist project, the socialist project, is an external factor. It's internal to Marxism, but only to the extent that the CIA or finance capital is able to subvert, right, the good Bolshevik Marxist-Leninist politics that comes out. There is no history in it because it's not a critique of history, the history of the workers' movement or the history of communism per se. It's an attempt to write off the failures of the 20th century, and the paranoia comes exactly out of the Stalinist period of the Great Purges of the 1930s. So like we're continuing with the politics of defeat that the 1930s represented without even having actually existing socialism to be defending against the CIA.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could argue that they're defending Xi against I don't know, people like us.
Xi's fine. The CIA is not going to get Xi anytime soon.
Yeah, I was about to say, and like, it's not like anyone in the Chinese Politburo has heard a goddamn thing I've ever said.
Was the failure of actually existing socialism down to Trotskyite wreckers in the 1930s, or or because of Khrushchev's revisionism, or was it because of like the Brezhnev doctrine? All of these are interesting historical questions, but I don't think any of them get at the heart of the real failure that 1917 to say 1922 represented in terms of the worldwide revolution. And the fact that Russia remains isolated and the working class is decimated within the Civil War, and the party ends up, for historical reasons, having to take the role of the class conscious proletariat in its attempt to build socialism with Russian characteristics.
I think when we look at this attempt to use that as, I mean, it's weird to me that you would appeal to MAGA, and you know, I'm not the only person. Tony of One Dime Radio actually says the same thing. It's weird to me that you would appeal to MAGA for as your basis for an American communism, and also be really up on like defending the DPRK and
well, Trump did meet with Kim Jong Un, right?
Yeah, and Cambodia, you know, which
Pol Pot.
Which I was about to say, the United States kind of helped Cambodia, but you know, for reasons of defeating the Russians via hurting the Vietnamese. And China got in on that to get revenge for the other thing about it is there's this tendency in Chinese communism to like make all your critiques hidden so you're not guilty of historical nihilism. But like there's a critique of Stalin and Mao. It's just not directly articulated. It's articulated as a defense of Stalin, but then also like, well, he didn't allow enough internal criticism. Mao says that in the 100 Flowers campaign, and he killed too many of the party members.
Oops, and mistakes were made.
Yeah, but what Mao can't get to is the problems that Mao has with Khrushchev actually go all the way back to Stalin's endorsement of the Kuomintang for sitting in the seat for China in the Comintern and not the Chinese Communist Party.
Mao's got a good reason to criticize that.
Shanghai massacre. Yeah.
I want to make another point about the Bevin's New Left thing, and maybe we can do it after the break for the paywall.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. There's a good time for it, folks. We're going to go behind the paywall. If you're an Antifada subscriber, you'll hear this on audio. Patreon.com/theAntifada. If you are not a patron yet, if you want to see the yassified version of me, if you want to see me all touched up by the algorithm, you can become a patron of a Varnblog, patreon.com/varnblog. We're going to continue this discussion, and we're also going to talk about maybe a cause for optimism and hope in some of the projects that we've been working on lately, some of the analysis that we've had, the works of the ILC and other groups. So if you're interested in that, if you're interested of getting out of the decay and into the renewal, we'll see you on the other side of the paywall.